the English and Martial Arts Podcast Show.
The Habbo radio station everyone loves.
I love them a lot.
Hello and welcome to the English Martial Arts Podcast Show. And in this episode, we have an interview with Niall Prince, who is the principal mentor at Oxford Sword and Staff. In this interview, we're going to discuss HEMA, the politics in HEMA, and the realities of HEMA in the modern world, and the sport of HEMA. So here we go. And the first thing I'll do is let Niall introduce himself to you.
Okay, so I'll do the introduction. So my name's Niall Prince. I'm currently the president of a HEMA club in Oxford called the Oxford Sword and Staff. So my HEMA journey, let's call it so far, is fairly brief. I've only been doing it for about a year and a half, actually. It started with an interest in Bartitsu originally. So I went out and looked around and tried to find a nearby Bartitsu club. The nearest one was about 30 miles away, which for someone that doesn't drive is, you know, a pretty serious commitment to try and get there and back once a week. So looking around, couldn't find anything that was already set up to go to in my area. And so I decided to set up my own club off the back of some sort of boots in the pants from the likes of TQ and people like that, who told me that, you know, just go out and do it sort of thing, which was much appreciated at the time. So, you know, as a lot of HEMA groups probably start, it was four blokes down the pub talking about what they wanted to do. So we had the chat, we decided on what we wanted to study, and then we just sort of booked a hall and saw what happened. And now we're a year and a half down the line. We've got, I think, about 20 members or something like that. So it's a growing thing, and it's very fun to be a part of, to start something up and see it grow. And you can work on a number of different things when you do that. So not only do you work on your sort of martial capability, you can also work on things like your teaching manner. And it's just really, really fun to do. And I'm pretty much a HEMA true blood. So I've not actually done martial arts beforehand, so I don't go into it with a sort of a 20-year background in karate or something like that that you right. see a lot of people doing. So yeah, that's a really, really quick sort of intro to where I am at the moment, how it all started. And you can pick that apart and pull other answers out of my brain if you want to.
So you're a HEMA enthusiast. So what are your main sources? Who do you follow in the, we'll say, Fiore or Silver?
So I'm a man of one marriage and many affairs. So what we do in the club is we work off of The Art of Combat by Joachim Meyer. So that's 1570 in the sort of in the Lichtenhauer lineage. It's got one foot in Lichtenhauer and another foot in sort of Italian sources and things like that. So that's the sort of key one.
Do you concentrate on certain weapons, or do you encompass all the weapons? Are you a long sword person, or do you train with staff, stick, single sword, double hand sword, etc.?
Yeah, so myself, I do long sword out of this text. That's what I started on. And then I moved over to pole arms, staff weapons. That's my kind of particular area of study in the text. What we do in the club is because this particular work of Meyer's starts on a long sword, goes to the dussak, goes to the rapier, goes to dagger and wrestling, and then it ends up on pole weapons. Now, with the growth of the club, what we've been able to do is we have specialized mentors that cover each one of those sort of styles. So we have our longsword tutor, we have our dussak tutor, we have myself that does the pole arms. We all kind of band together for the dagger and wrestling. And we're currently on the lookout for a rapier teacher. So if anyone's listening, they want to do some rapier in Oxford, give me a shout.
I'm sure there are plenty of people that are in Oxford. I mean,
yeah, HEMA is coming out of the woodwork, man.
Yeah. Yeah. So your particular interest is in pole arms. Is that all pole arms or certain kind?
Yeah, so I've been working on... So Joachim starts with the Halbenstangen or the quarter staff. So, you know, we use 6-foot bow staffs for that because they're just easily obtainable, and they're pretty much there. They're on the shorter end of the historical spectrum. You look in the treaties, they would even more in the 7 foot range.
Yeah, do you find that when you get bow staffs that the wood is bad, like the red oak and the white oak stuff, because they kiln dry it, they break a lot?
Well, I've torn through two red oak ones. The last one I had fell victim to a fairly enthusiastic umschlag, and so a big strike that starts from one side of you, moves around the back of your head and comes out the other side, so it's got a lot of power into it. Struck a fairly solid target with that, and that just shivered all the way down.
Yeah. So,
that was a pain. The other one was just not worth the tree it came from. It had fallen apart from day one.
Yeah.
But I've just got an ash staff. We just had a big order of ash staffs coming in. So we're going to wait and see how that goes.
Yeah, ash is good wood. We've got some ash staffs and they really do take some beating before anything happens to them. They're great.
Yeah, it feels really nice in hand. It's just that little bit lighter than red oak or something like that. But I've had no problems with it so far. I've not had it long, so I'm sure there might be one pop up. One problem.
You never know.
We'll see how that goes.
Yeah. So, when you practice your staff work, do all your pole arms come from that weapon, or is it like learning a new system for each pole arm?
They kind of feed into each other. So, that's the kind of concept for the entire work that Uakan put together. Everything feeds into the next thing. Right. So like in broad terms, you learn all your fundamentals of the sword and the long sword. You take those over into the dusak, so you're moving from a two-handed weapon to a one-handed weapon. But the stance remains very similar. A lot of the cuts are thrown in very similar fashions. And then that moves on into the rapier as well. So everything feeds in.
Yeah.
In the pole arm section, you have a sort of miniaturized version of that. So you start on the quarter staff. And then that gets the sort of base movements programmed into you. And then you move on to something like the halberd, which is great fun to work on. It's really dangerous, but then that's part of the fun. So you have your basic movements from the quarterstaff, but then you've got a nice big axe head and a big hook on the other end of it. So that pulls in some more techniques, which is really fun, like ripping out hamstrings of the person across from you. Yeah. You know, all that stuff that we always really want to get into when we start doing all this medieval combat, all the really nice visceral stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I got into it. And then that moves on in this text. So you do quarterstaff through the halberd, and then you move on to the pike, which is, you know, the big 11-foot, 12-foot thing, which is just, I haven't had a chance to play with it yet, but I've seen some people, Roger Norling, for example, who's very impressive with his Mayer pike work. But yeah, so it all feeds into one another.
Right. I mean, it sounds like a complete system. So it goes from long weapons to medium weapons to short weapons to wrestling. So it sounds like you've got everything you need in your system. Do you still include things from other systems in it?
Well, we try to stay within the system for the purposes of just continuity and things like that. But if people have other interests or things like that, we put on regular sort of free play sessions where we supply the space for people to do their own studies. So we do encourage looking at other systems as well, because you can pick up things from one system that you would never find in the other. And that's how you become a good sort of fighter and fencer, is you learn as many techniques as you can and learn how to apply them.
So what's the philosophy of your sort of or yourself and your students? What kind of philosophy do you instill in them? Because many martial arts have sort of things on the wall that say a martial artist should defend the weak, should protect their community, blah blah blah. And you know, they study things like they have Zen Shin and do you do anything like that? Do you instill anything like that in your students and yourself?
It's kind of not as applicable to what we do in the respect, because when it was written, during the time of the Holy Roman Empire, the sort of basis behind it was a sort of self-defense manual, a sort of Holy Roman, you know, go out and do your thing for the motherland kind of vibe to it. So we don't try and put any particular philosophies. I mean, you do get some people that look at, you know, much older traditions and they've got, you know, the seven knightly virtues and things like that.
Yeah.
In terms of martial arts influencing behavior or certainly guiding people, I would just hope that anyone that I have in my club isn't a prat and, you know, doesn't go out looking for fights and doesn't, you know, beat
absolutely, people. Absolutely, yeah.
But I suppose, like, I personally like to try and nurture a sort of a scholarly attitude to it as well. The drive to go and research it, and the drive to delve deep into the things that we're studying, I suppose. That would be what I do, and what I hope a lot of other people do as well.
Yeah. I mean, when Terry Brown, myself and others first started, I mean, Terry started researching in the 70s. I mean, me near the end of the 70s and the 80s, and we had to find all our stuff in libraries. We had to go to the British Library and travel.
Yeah.
Do you find the internet is helpful for study, or do you still, when you do your research, still go to these old libraries and research?
Well, we're sort of at a point now where everything's available online, be that if you go and look on Lichtenauer or Wichtenauer, or you order the books online and get them delivered. There's less requirement to go to libraries because everything is so available.
Yeah.
I like having physical copies of things.
Me too.
I never got into e-books or anything like that. I grew up with books. I grew up with the smell of books, the feel of a book in your bag and things like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I always try and get hard copies. And obviously when you do that, you're supporting the people that went out and put all their time and effort into translating them and things like that. So, you know, I've made a point of going out and getting The Art of Combat, obviously, because it's that core treatise. I've got a couple of others. I've got something on I-33. I've got Colonel Monster's book that is a really fun sort of 19th century self-defense clash pugilism thing. I like the physical copies. If I'm doing something that's a little bit, you know, I haven't quite committed to it yet, like I'm quite a keen user of the Montante.
Okay.
Just in terms of time that I've got to put into it, I don't have as much. So that I do kind of, you know, I've got some PDFs that I found online and things like that.
Yeah, the Montante does seem to be quite popular these days.
It's lovely. It's I think some of it comes from it being, at its heart, a fairly simple system with a lot of intricate applications.
Mm.
So the base of the Montante is you have a cut to the right, a cut to the left, a cut from downwards, and that forms the core of it because it's such a big weapon.
Yeah. Have you ever held any originals?
Yeah, so actually not too long ago, a month or so, we popped over to the Wallace Collection and had a handling session there of pure original pieces.
I used to work in there, and I must have held every sword in there. It's a great place. Jealous. It is just one of the best places.
It's beautiful, and you know, there was the Swiss saber. Got in there. I think I'm the only person in the entire world to ever hold and go, no, I'm not a fan. because I don't know, maybe it's my meaty man paws or something like that. It just
probably
didn't fit me. But they've got a beautiful Landsmesser in there that came out, and Estoc, which is like, I think the guy in the club who's a sergeant at arms says it's about as close to handling a real lightsaber as you'll ever get because there's just zero blade weight on it. You know?
Yeah, there is. There's literally nothing. Did you hold the Medici Felsham?
I don't think so. I was very enraptured in just holding them. I forgot to ask what most of them were.
Yeah, you need to write a list before you go next time.
Yeah, well, that's the well. We chatted to the Wallace Collection, and they said, "Well, what do you want to handle?" And we sort of put in this massive, great, big, long list of basically everything, please. But what they then did is, when we got there, is they took the time to make sure we were only handling, you know, fully original pieces rather than something that's had, you know, a Victorian pommel knocked on at some point, or you know, it's had some bits hacked off because it looked nicer over someone's fireplace.
That's absolutely, yeah. It is an amazing place. It is an amazing place for an armory.
It was beautiful, and for me, the takeaway was, you know, we handle so many swords and practice swords and sharp swords that are made today, but you don't get the feeling you get off handling something which is made for the express purpose of killing someone.
No, and I'll tell you another thing as well, the weights, how different the weights are.
Yeah, these were like that Landsmesser.
Mm.
You probably held it if you were around there. And it was there at the time.
Absolutely.
It basically felt like we weren't holding much at all.
Yeah.
If you tilted it just past a straight-up angle, it immediately wanted to just fall forwards and cut whatever was in front of it.
Absolutely. I mean, some of the weapons, the skills the bladesmiths and armourers had in those days, I think far outweigh the ones that are now reproducing today. So I think it might be simply because they haven't got originals to go off of in a lot of places, especially places in America and things like that. So they're trying to get it down to weights that are quoted in manuals and that, but they're nothing like the original when you hold the original. Have you found that?
Yeah, definitely. I think the quality of the Smiths, the Bladesmiths that we've got at the moment is really quite high in terms of the people putting out HEMA-specific manufactured things.
Yeah.
But yeah, there is a difference between the period pieces and what we have now. Whether or not that's down to the fact that, you know, we don't have bladesmiths whose sole job it is now is to churn out sort of military orders. So they don't have thousands of hours behind them. Just, no. You know, being able to fit, like, what if I put the balance point just half a centimetre further on this one, or what if I put it just, you know, 3 mil backwards?
Mm.
But I definitely think it's getting back to really, really, really good. I mean, obviously people like Peter Regnier have been doing it for a long time.
And yeah, beautiful swords.
Just beautiful swords, yeah. Horses. They take the abuse. They feel nice in the hand. And there's loads of new ones coming out. So Kvetan Armoury, I've heard nothing but good things from them.
Yeah, some of these places, they really do produce some amazing blades.
Yeah.
They really do. So if we move on a little bit, what is your view on the state of HEMA today? Do you think it's too sport-oriented? Do you think it's too martial-oriented? Or do you think there's an even balance?
I don't know. I think it's sort of it's at a nice place balance-wise. Obviously, there is some sportification in terms of like longsword and sabre and things like that. They kind of naturally lend themselves to being sportified. So there will always be highlights on the longsword tournaments, you know, things like Swordfish and Sword Squatch.
Yes.
And things like that. And I'm fine with that. You know, as long as you treat, in my mind, as long as you treat tourney fighting as different to the martial side of it, then that's fine. But, you know, I try and keep the ethos of it's a martial tradition that, you know, you learn to stop yourself from being killed and to ideally kill other people.
Absolutely,
But I think, there's definitely a place for tourneys and sports sides of it, because that, you know, I've fought some tourney fences, and they're excellent fences. They're really, really good, and it hones their skills brilliantly, having that kind of environment to work in. But so, I do appreciate the maintenance of it as a martial tradition as well. I know there's lots of schools that do that as well.
Yeah. Do you think that the sporting side is what keeps interest in HEMA, or do you think that has nothing to do with it?
Interest in HEMA, I've always found, is a mixed bag. You know, you get people like myself that probably come out of it. So I really used to enjoy martial arts movies and things like that. So I always wanted to learn one, but I didn't have the drive to learn Kung Fu or Karate or something like that. But I also loved, you know, fantasy stories and things like that. So that's where my interest in medieval fighting comes from.
Conan.
Yeah, Conan and... what are you called?
The Three Musketeers.
Three Musketeers, the 70s versions are brilliant.
Yeah.
So I think you find loads of people that come in from that side of things, loads of people that love fantasy and fighting films. You got historical buffs that come in that just love delving into those periods of history. You've got the sporty guys, the tourney fencers that come in because they relish the challenge of a tournament fight. You got LARPers that just enjoy having that sort of next stage to go up on. So they fight people with foam swords as a character, and then they can fight people with steel swords as themselves.
Yeah.
I think that the whole gamut of interests that feed into HEMA is so big. I don't think it's like one thing or the other.
Right. Do you think it all split into its different sections as time goes on, rather than just being a big mix?
Maybe. I think that the community is together as much as it can be to hold it together. And I think that's a really good thing. We've got quite a rigid community, strong community to fall back on, which maybe acts as a kind of guiding light for that, to maybe stop it from splintering off into all different directions. Maybe. I don't know. That's a casual observation, if you will.
Yeah. I suppose, I mean, when your interests lie in a martial art, you don't really take much notice of what happens in the world of martial arts. You're more concentrated on what you're doing and what everyone else is doing.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, you do. You you can have quite a sort of introspective look on it and just focus on what you do and maybe the people that directly relate to you. Yeah, that can definitely happen.
Yeah. So where are you going from here? Where are you planning on opening other clubs or concentrating on just building up the one you have?
So the club is run by, it's a club, there's myself, there's vice president, there's secretary, and there's sergeant at arms. And that's the sort of council, if you will. So we discuss things like that quite regularly. And I actually live, I recently moved away from Oxford. So I'm now 60-mile round trip to get there and back, which I do each week.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's me club, my baby. And yeah, we think of, so the club's pretty big, as I said, about 20 members. And when you've got even 12 in a hall with quarter staffs, that space is really small.
Yeah.
So we're looking at maybe moving venues to a bigger place, and that then gives us the room to grow the club even more.
Right.
As I said, we recently moved on to a sort of specialised build. So you have people that mentor. We try not to use the word teach because we're all sort of learning together. But you have people that mentor the longsword, people that mentor the polearm, people that mentor the Dussac. There's also, you know, I now live over in Swindon Way. There's lots of interest over here in HEMA. There's already, I think it's the Wessex School of Arms that's up and running over here. So, you know, I might open a sister wing to the Oxford Sword and Staff over here.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very tempting.
So what do you think about politics within HEMA or martial arts in general? Do you think it should be in there or do you think it should be kept out completely? Because I do know myself, because I know lots of HEMA people and martial arts people, and some people do try to push an agenda. What's your feelings on that?
I'm one of those people that tries to keep politics out of the other things I do. I think there are definitely certain aspects of politics we all should be aware of as HEMAites. We should be aware of things like the new weapon legislations and things like that, and they're coming, and how that could influence, you know,
absolutely,
the accessibility of our training gear.
Yeah.
I think that if it moves into just sort of government bashing, that gets a bit far. And we've also got to be aware of, there was that whole thing a little while ago about white supremacists kind of latching onto HEMA. It was all a massive to-do, but it was a load of poop over nothing.
Oh, no.
I think we do need to be aware of certain aspects of the political landscape. But Personally, I would leave that to the sort of individual's discretion rather than trying to incorporate a political view into, say, a club.
That's fair enough. I mean, I've just read all the new legislation for the weapons, because at our club we use lots and lots of different kinds of weapons, as you do yourself probably. And it seems to be the same banned list with one more new weapon added, the zombie knife.
I mean,
yeah, that whole, is it a machete or something?
It's the zombie knife. I've got one somewhere. I probably shouldn't say that, but I won it in a lottery. You know?
Oh, right.
When they went into liquidation, there was a Comic-Con that I was at where they were basically giving them away because they were soon to become illegal. But that was just knee-jerk reaction to something that happened. And if you look at the descriptions that they actually put out, you know, as official government paperwork, it's, you know, they could have one or two sides, they could be between 8 and 12 inches, they could be serrated, they could have slogans on them.
Yeah,
it's basically, you could look at anything and say, well, that might be a zombie knife.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but I don't think it will affect historical or historical replicas, especially for people who train, because the last lot of legislation didn't, so I'm hoping that this lot doesn't either.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, isn't it? We're at the point where we're in a hope, you know, we can but hope sort of scenario.
Yeah.
And, yeah, hopefully, you know, the fact that it's becoming more well-known as a martial art, as a hobby, as a sport, hopefully that can be a sort of protective thing.
Yeah.
Where it's, you know, it's not weaponry, it's fencing supplies and sporting goods and things like that. But we'll wait and see, because all it takes is, you know, one bloke on customs could say, no, that's a fencing tool, that's fine, and you go. And the other one could say, no, that's a sword, that's staying here.
Yep, absolutely. So do you take your martial arts out into your normal life? Does it help you in any way?
I think that, in ways,
I mean, philosophy wise, or maybe you even use your footwork to get through a crowd, you know, that kind of thing, where people train while they're walking along the streets, and people use different aspects of what they do in their day-to-day life.
I mean, yeah, you can. It becomes what you make it, I suppose. Mm. There's always things like, if you have a martial art and it provides a focus point for you, you know, in terms of, say, mental well-being, you can take that into your life off the back of it.
Mm.
In terms of the physical stuff, yeah, I mean, my balance was absolutely terrible before I started doing this. So I do find that I can walk a bit more confidently. I can, as you say, move through crowds so that you can slip about a little bit.
Yeah.
Whether or not that's just me now being more aware of myself when I move through or around people.
Yeah. You do become more aware of what's around you and who's around you.
Yeah, you can do. And I think that happens if you let it, rather than something that will always happen.
Yeah, you can't force it.
No, not at all. There's one thing that pops up in the art of combat, and I like playing with kind of academic ideas, and one that I've been playing with is the application of what you learn in fencing to your outlook.
Mm.
And there's a sort of key ethos in Mayer's way of fencing, which is to provoke an action, remove that action, and then counter that with one of your own. So provoke, take, hit.
And
I've been playing with the idea of that translating into, there's never anything that's outside of your control, would be a nice mental way of looking at it. So in fencing terms, you're in a situation where you don't have direct control over it until you take it and you make that movement that then puts you in a situation that is in your control and something you can work with. And I think that outlook, if you can take that from fencing, is brilliant, because I know lots of people that sometimes struggle with feeling that they're being borne along on a tide of something that they can't control.
Yes, yes. I mean, so I you notice that with beginners that. A lot, don't you? You notice when people first start, they're overwhelmed with the information they get, and it takes time for them to sort of get into the groove.
Yeah, there's a lot to take in with something like this, because, you know, with... if you think it's karate or kung fu or something like that, you learn to punch. Right? Everyone's punched at least once before in their life before they set foot in a dojo. That's just pretty much a given. The likelihood of someone having to swing a longsword before they set foot in a club's hall is pretty minimal, you know.
Well, yeah, practically non-existent.
Yeah, and that onslaught of sort of education and learning and teaching at the beginning can be very overwhelming, because there's a lot to learn.
Yeah. There is a lot to learn with weapons, especially about safety and control.
Yeah, safety and control and respect for what you're doing.
Yeah.
I just did. So at the moment, we're in a block of quarter staff sessions with my club. And we've done, I would say, about 12 hours on it before this lesson.
Right.
And this lesson was the first time I actually got people in range and landing hits on each other. Very, very, very light hits with a mask and stuff like that. But instilling the respect for the weapon takes time.
Yeah. I mean, the quarterstaff is my favourite weapon.
I've seen some of your stuff on YouTube.
I do really love the quarterstaff, yeah. But I do like short weapons as well. And being the modern days, the way things are going, you mean, you look at London, because I live in London, and the way things are going, you do need a good sort of knowledge of how short weapons can be used against you, as well as, you know, how they can come in, et cetera, et cetera. So making things practical as well as theoretical is part of what we do as well in our club.
That's good to hear, that is, because I was actually only having the discussion with a fellow Hemerite the other day about, you know, there's this sort of ongoing discussion, is HEMA applicable in the real world, if you will?
Well, yeah,
it certainly is. I mean, even back to what we've got with the art of combat in the dagger section, you can take the dagger out of someone's hands, and I know this is the case of Fiore as well, you can lose the dagger and look at the movements, and you have the basis for an unarmed defence system.
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of the medieval systems, especially the one you have, are quite big on wrestling.
So, yeah, we've got a bit of wrestling. It tends to sort of revolve around the central theme of throw your big leg behind someone and throw them over it, whether or not you're gripping them by the shoulder, the trousers, the throat, or something like that.
Yeah. But you can adapt, can't you? Locks. I mean, you can adapt what you learn. I mean, a martial art is an organic thing, yeah? It lives and breathes with the people that train it. So as time goes on, people make it their own and things are adapted. So if somebody does a job like me, I work the doors. So if somebody does a job like me, you have to adapt what you learn so that it fits what you do.
Yeah.
So I would say HEMA is 100% applicable in those situations. Because if you, I mean, obviously you can just do it as a pastime, a theory thing, a sports thing. That's, as you say, that is absolutely part of everything HEMA is. But there are people that also do it for the practical reasons as well, because they find that the historical European martial arts fits what they do better. Have you found anything like that?
Not really. I've not had very many opportunities to try and apply it practically, shall we say.
I don't mean actually using it. I mean having the two different mindsets, the martial mind, which is the side where you train it so that it's practical if you need it, and then the other side where you research and you have loads of fun training, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I mean, my mindset has always been that those two ways of looking are equally as important to each other,
yeah,
if you will. Because if we don't do the one, we can't do the other. Think about it. If we don't research, we can't put what we research into context. If we don't do what we research, we can't then go back to what we researched and figure out what was correct from our, you know, assumptions and how we build on it from there.
Absolutely, yeah. So to your mind, the HEMA you practice is a martial art as well as a fun hobby to do.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah,
it's learning how to fight in a certain style.
Yeah.
And with it comes this brilliant and vibrant community of loads of different people.
Yeah.
And even, you know, boiling it down to longswordists, you've got a great community of longswordists because you've got Lichtenauer, you know, lineage people, you've got Ring X, you've got Fiorians.
Yeah.
All people with different mindsets, all people attracted to their different systems for different reasons, and that contributes to a really big melting pot of sort of, it's like cultural diversity in a hobby, if you will.
Yeah, I suppose it is really when you think about it.
Yeah.
So how is your name Neil?
So my name is Niall.
Niall, okay.
Yeah, the spelling of it that I put out is, I mean, there's a certain amount of...
Is that Scandinavian or...?
Yeah, so I did some research and things like that. And so my name's Niall, and that comes from Irish.
Irish, yeah.
And then that feeds back into, sort of Scandinavian.
Okay, yeah.
And the version that you probably saw on Facebook with the weird kind of three symbol.
Yeah, that is the one,
Yeah, that's Anglo-Saxon.
Anglo-Saxon,
so
yeah.
That three symbol is the Y sound, so it's N-Y-A-L-L.
No.
But yeah, it's a bit of an affectation to make yourself stand out a little bit.
That's
another thing that I quite like about HEMA is you can be showy if you want to.
You can be who you want.
Yeah, exactly.
And what you want.
I mean, we had a new person turn up to the club who only realised that we were a German fencing club because she walked past in one of our sessions. She saw the kind of trousers I was wearing.
Right. Okay.
You know, I thought when I started, I've got to represent this German fighting tradition. I've got to get myself into the correct sort of appearance.
Yeah.
So I went out and I spoke to the guys over at High Heel Pants, and they made me a brilliant set of huge sort of Lanzknecht knickerbockers, I suppose you could call them. And that's, again, that feeds into the showmanship and the marketing.
Yeah.
And
don't walk down the street in them.
Well, I've done it. I've been in McDonald's with my massive pants on.
Yeah. Brilliant. That's funny, that is. Yeah, I remember training, I was with Terry and we were shooting the photos for the book English Martial Arts, and we had to wear the original stuff, and I had to go and make a phone call, and I had to use a phone box, and I had to go out in my 6-inch heels with me.
Yeah.
It was murder. So I twisted my ankle about 6 times training in them shoes.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, I know, because they're like wearing women's high heels.
That's crazy. Yeah. I couldn't imagine fencing in high heels. But
I know, but they did.
It's possible.
They did. That's the thing. I suppose human beings adapt to whatever's around them, and they do whatever they have to.
Well, yeah, and there's a whole subset of sort of HEMA and things like that devote time to learning how to do it in the clothing of the time and how that can influence your movement and things like that.
Yeah.
I think there was something I saw come out, or it might not come out recently, but I saw it recently about, what's the fella's name? Roland, he's a fella over in, I want to say Poland, but I could be wrong, but he sort of devoted himself to studying everything about the time period. And he came up with some theories about how people used to walk differently. And
I've seen
like
that. Is that Roland Wachaser or
that's, that's the genuine question.
Yeah.
And that stuff is invaluable if you delve that deep.
Yeah.
And something, you know, some techniques make sense because you're like, oh, okay, so I would start with my foot facing a different angle to what I do naturally. And that makes it feel a lot more, a lot less constricted.
Yeah. I mean, I try and bring a lot of sort of modern training aspects into doing our martial art because things have moved on so much. So with the exercise and diet and things like that, do you do the same kind of thing?
We tend to reserve the time that we have in clubs for learning to fence.
Mm.
We sort of had the conversation, myself and the current VP, a little while ago about how much we should, you know, look into establishing exercise routines and things like that. And we came to the conclusion there's plenty of places that people can go to get in shape, but there's only one place they can come to learn how to fight with a longsword.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, yeah, yeah, why not? Why not? Every gym is different, I suppose.
Definitely. Again, one of the great things, I know some gyms that do, you know, 30, 40-minute explosive warm-up before everything.
Yeah.
You know.
Absolutely.
Which is brilliant. Yeah. It's definitely got its place if you want to do that.
Yeah.
Rock on. More power to you. We're just lazy, I suppose.
So do you have, as part of your art, we, in the English martial arts, we have the principles as written down by Silver. Do you have something similar?
Well, it's a sort of, in the Lichtenau tradition, there's what's called the Zettel, which you might have come across it. Mm. And that's the sort of the big mnemonic poem about, you know, committing all that to memory and you remember everything about the art that you possibly ever need to.
Yeah.
Which I suppose is can be viewed as that. When it comes down to us in Maya, as I said, we've got one foot in the Lichtenau tradition and one foot outside of it somewhere else. We're a little bit special. So in terms of sort of guiding philosophies and things like that, it's a little sparse.
Mm.
As I say, it's more to do with, you know, being a good citizen of the empire, and the whole book was written, you know, for one particular patron. So it gets a little bit sort of pandering about being manly and you know, the most artful and manly applications of weapons and things.
I think they all did that in those days, didn't they?
Yeah, if you were to take it literally and have it enforce you, you'd go around being a proud German and just accepting that the only people to do fencing are going to be big manly men. Which is not true.
Which it wasn't true either. I mean, there were plenty of female fencers that were very good.
I love characters in historical context.
Yeah.
I said earlier that I'd look at Monstery. He's, if you've not looked into him, Colonel Thomas Monstery.
Yeah, I have, yes. Yeah, because we're big on pugilism in the English martial arts. We're very, very big on pugilism. So anything we can get, we read and we look at. And Monstery, nice. Yeah, and Monstery was the latest, I think, one that people are promoting.
Yeah, he's coming back on with some popularity now, I think. Yeah. There's quite a few people that are aware of him.
Yeah. I mean, if people want to improve their pugilism, they should look at people like Fitzsimmons and Dempsey. The thing about pugilism is it's such a massive art. It's not small. It's a massive art, and it encompasses a whole lot of stuff. And if anybody's interested in pugilism, I recommend that they look up, especially people like Broughton and Jack Slack, the Norwich Butcher, people like that, and see the kind of techniques they used.
Mm.
You know, it's really, really interesting and really thought-provoking.
It is. It's a fascinating side of it. I've seen, you know, Oz's videos and things on it all, and it is. It's a really supremely fascinating subject.
Mm.
Because it goes through all those different, as you say, stages between, you know, punch-ups.
Absolutely. I mean, you had the London prize ring rules. I mean, and compare them to the rules you've got now. They're worlds apart. Mm. Different arts completely. They really are.
It's amazing to be able to track that lineage so well because, obviously, the amount of newspaper reports, you know, things like that, that you have from the times when it was an ongoing thing. It's just an invaluable resource for being able to see how it grew and developed and all the changes that came into it.
Yeah, it is a fascinating art, and the men and the women that were involved in it are fascinating people. You know, they may have come from the working class of England or wherever, but as people and as characters and as they built themselves through the art, they became heroes. They became, you know, heroes of England and places like that. It's still the same today. People who are in boxing, you know, they come from nowhere and then they become world champion and their name's a household name. And I must thank you for taking the time to talk to me.
I'll tell you what, it's
fascinating to talk to people who are involved in the, you don't like the term Western martial arts, but historical European martial arts. And thank you very much for that. It's fascinating. And I'm glad that your club's doing so well.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure being on here. It's been great to chat to you.
Absolutely, Niall. Thank you very much. And maybe one day, if I can get up there or you can get down here, we can train together.
Awesome. We'll stick that in the diary for some point.
That'd be brilliant. I'd love to.
No worries, mate. We'll make it happen.
Okay, Niall. Thank you very much.
Listen to us, because we'll listen to you. Do, 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 do.